This is Originally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Indiana's gaming industry is picking back up after the pandemic and knocked it down considerably. Let's check the latest. Ed Feigenbaum is the creator and editor of the Indiana Gaming Insight and the Indiana Legislative Insight newsletters from Hanna News Service. He's with us from Indianapolis. Ed, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Great to be with you, Chris, and we'll be talking about tailwinds for the casino industry.
Yeah, that's why it seems that the headline showed that they've managed to pick back up here, at least in the latest report from the Indiana Gaming Commission. They've not bounced back completely, but they're making their way, I understand.
Well, it depends upon what you want to refer to as a complete comeback. I think the industry folks are very, very happy with where they're at, because if you look at one measure, which would be, you know, what they're actually bringing in, you know, after expenses and everything, I think they're probably in a better position than they were a year ago. If you look at the July numbers, and July is the first full month that we've had of casino gaming at all 13 properties, and the first full month that we've had since the casinos closed on March 15th, you'll see that the revenues were only down by about 5.4% over the year, by about $10 million. But consider that effectively half the capacity is gone from the casinos. So they're not operating as many slot machines. They're not operating as many table games, or they don't have as many table positions. They have fewer employees generally, although, you know, they do have a bigger complement of the sanitation employees now, but those are generally, you know, at a lower level than, for example, dealers and some of the administrative staff. And so the expenses are down a bit from what they were before. You know, the restaurants aren't fully staffed. They're not operating all of the dining options that they might have had before. So if their income is only down by about 5%, and you look at what their expenses are, you know, payroll may be down. I heard one casino CEO say that their employee expenses were down by about 20%. Payroll was off, actually, at this one property by 22%. Marketing costs were way down because, you know, essentially they were just opening their doors and seeing what walked in. And so your general earnings after expenses are going to be considerably higher. This one CEO is saying, and this is a CEO of a company that operates in Indiana, that his earnings before depreciation and income taxes and amortization was 30% higher than it was a year ago.
When you talk about the changes, of course, that had to be made because of getting the casinos reopened from the pandemic and the shutdown that is ordered by the governor, and all of the expenses that they had to put into that, are they figuring those are they'll just have to eat those, and that's not going to count too much against the earnings that they have? They'll make up for that in time?
Well, I think that they'll probably make up for that, you know, in other areas. You know, they're finding that If they're bringing in as much income as they are now with only, you know, half or 75% of the slot machines that they had a year ago, you know, why do they need that additional expense? Yeah. And you're going to see some of those things pared down. You're going to see some of the expensive things like buffets go away because of public health requirements. And in some cases, you know, some casinos were already starting to change those to some type of delivered food options as opposed to, you know, an open buffet even before the pandemic hit, just because of the expenses and the number of people that were using that and the ability of staff to cope with that. So there are going to be some permanent changes that you're going to see. Some of them will be saving some money, and, you know, if they're going to have to be purchasing PPE for the employees, if they're going to be having to purchase masks and all the sanitation equipment, the, you know, hand sanitizer, the sprays that, you know, the employees are going to have to go and use after every patron uses a stool at a slot machine or a chair at a table game, you know, certainly that's going to be up. But I think on balance, they're not going to be totally unhappy with where they are. Now, the flip side of that, Chris, is that you know, we don't know how normal these circumstances are today.
Right.
You know, when the casinos reopened in July, they opened in essentially a pretty good position because there weren't a whole lot of other entertainment options for people. Movie theaters are still closed. There's no, you know, high school sports. There's no professional sports. You know, people couldn't be going to a Cubs game or a Sox game or a professional soccer game, an NBA game, instead of going to a casino. So the casinos opened in a pretty good position compared to where they might have been, you know, a year ago, where they would have been competing against other entertainment options for the patron dollar.
I wonder if there's been any thought or any discussion, you would might have gotten some indication from this, amongst the casino operators, whether, of course, you have the restrictions as to how many people you can let into a room. But I wonder if some of the venues, literally like the venue, which is at Horseshoe Casino in Hammond, all the places that basically have theaters or entertainment points within the buildings which had to close because of the shutdown, if they can try and reopen them to some point, and then in turn they'll offer up some kind of entertainment options aside from just gambling?
Oh, you'll see some of that as well, and I think that Horseshoe Casino Hammond had done very well with that. The new Hard Rock Northern Indiana is opening with essentially a showroom, and they've got different options that they can bring into, and, you know, it's not just shows. You know, Horseshoe brought in, you know, boxing, mixed martial arts, the Thunder from Down Under review, all kinds of different things. So you'll see some of that as well. But right now, the problem isn't reaching capacity. You essentially only saw capacity limits hit maybe on the first day at some of the properties. So it's not a question of managing your patron load and trying to divert some of the people from, you know, Saturday nights to Tuesday mornings or something. You know, people are coming in and they're spending a little bit more than they might have spent when more people came in a year ago.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering that question because I know that that's always, of course, and certainly here in Northwest Indiana, that's always been the key because of some of the venues which used to be around that had to close, and the fact that the casinos with
they've kind of picked up
the load after the theater closed in here in Merrillville, and some of the venues that entertainers could go to for their performances that had to shift to the casino rooms, so to speak, or casino theaters, I should say. So I just wondered if that's going to help the entertainment business here in Northwest Indiana a bit now that we're seeing the business pick up at the casinos.
Well, we're still going to have to see some of the capacity limitations lifted by the governor. You know, that 250-person limit on those types of venues is going to have to change.
Lots of things look right now from what you've seen in the latest reports on how the sports books have been doing. Have they been able to bounce back as much as the casino propers have?
The sports books have done pretty well as well. Not so much the retail sports books as the online and mobile apps, but those have been doing pretty good business. The online and mobile apps have accounted for, you know, between about 75% and 80% of the business. And it's been a little slower for the retail sports books to bounce back, but that's to be expected, not only because of the changing, you know, patronization patterns, but also because now you can do some limited retail sports betting in Illinois, and you've got at least one operator now doing mobile sports betting, I should say, in Illinois, and you've got some limited sports wagering in Michigan too. That kind of started about a week before the pandemic shut down everything. So there's a little bit more competition for that dollar, and we're starting to see some of that evidenced in the numbers. And you also don't have a full complement of wagering available to you in terms of the types of sports that are out there. You know, you don't have people excited yet about college football because we don't know if there's going to be a college football season. You've got some strange goings on with respect to Major League Baseball. You don't know whether, for example, the St. Louis Cardinals are going to be able to finish out their season. The Cardinals are coming to town to Chicago next weekend to play the White Sox. Well, Do we know if they're really going to be able to play? They've had to cancel their last three series because of COVID-19. So there are all kinds of different things that are affecting the wagering patterns, and you also don't have National Football League betting that's fully open. You've got some futures bets, but you know, again, that's a little bit risky right now for the players, at least in terms of putting some money down and knowing what you're wagering on, because you don't know necessarily what the schedule is going to be, whether there are going to be some changes there. And obviously, individual game wagers will be refunded if those games don't take place. But if you're making a bet on, you know, who's going to win the Super Bowl or how the season's going to end with particular win-loss records or something, you're not going to be able to recoup those dollars until everything's said and done.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have some other interesting things going on in terms of the 40,000-foot view, Chris, you know, with respect to the sale coming up, potential sale, we should say, of Horseshoe Casino Hammond and then two other properties in the state.
I was going to ask you about that next, is how things are coming along with that.
Well, we don't know and we won't know, but there are some interesting variables going on there. Now, of course, with the merger of Caesars and Eldorado Entertainment, Eldorado Resorts, Inc., Eldorado agreed to divest three casinos in Indiana, and they said that the three properties that they would be looking at selling would be Horseshoe Casino Hammond, Tropicana Evansville, and Caesars Southern Indiana. Now, Horseshoe, obviously, is the premier property in the state, should bring the biggest sales price, but there are all kinds of strange variables out there right now. First is that everybody knows that Eldorado has to divest those three properties here in Indiana, has to have a sales agreement by December 31st. So there's a forced sale, and people know that they're under the gun to do this. Now, there are also other properties that Eldorado has agreed to divest around the country, some in New Jersey, I think Missouri, and one or two other states. So there are going to be a whole lot of properties that are on the market, and that also tends to obviously lower the prices. In addition, you've got the question about what the outlook for the casinos is really going to be. You know, you're essentially selling right now at a very uncertain point, and it's not good for the seller. It is good for the buyer, though. And you know, when you look at the flip side here, yes, it's not good for Eldorado, but you may get a buyer who comes in and gets a property at a rock bottom price and then has more money to invest in upgrading the property, adding on, you know, maybe a hotel in Hammond, those types of things.
Right.
So, you know, there are pluses and minuses to this, but it's going to be interesting to see, you know, who's in the market for these properties. You've got the uncertainty of the Chicagoland market that's affecting this. You know, maybe a casino coming to Chicago at some time. We still don't know when, but you know, obviously the legislation back in the spring, I think it was in May, mm-hmm. made it much more likely with the changes and all the tax considerations in Illinois, made it much more likely for a casino to site in Chicago. You've also got Hard Rock Northern Indiana that's going to be open at some point in 2021. So the market is going to be different. Nobody knows quite how that's all going to pan out with respect to, again, the change in the whole casino market given the pandemic. And also, when you take that out to look at the even broader question of consumer confidence and the economy in the United States in general, and how people are going to be spending their money or saving it instead.
Well, it sounds like there's a lot more to talk about in the future. And like you say, we still haven't heard officially yet about the changeover on the casino. So that'll probably be a good conversation point the next time we get together. Thanks a lot for being with us today, Ed.
Lots of things to occupy us. Appreciate you having me as your guest today, Chris.
Well, you're certainly welcome to join us. Ed Feigenbaum is the creator, and he's the editor of the Indiana Gaming Insight, the Indiana Legislative Insight newsletters published by the Hanna News Service. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversations to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
So we moved to Coutts in October of 67. We had very good neighbors. The Martins were across the street. Fishers were on the corner. George and Garlock and his brother lived behind us. And his brother Spud died that spring. And George was very, very lonesome. He was apprehensive about this family moving in with two small kids. But he just became another grandfather to him. And that was really my introduction to neighboring in Couts. You know, this is rural America. It's small town. And back in those days, there were many more farms. The farms were smaller. And on these farms, there were jobs that you couldn't do by yourself. And so you became close with your neighbor and you shared. I'll share one story with you about George Garlock. I mentioned earlier that he was lonesome, but he had a pool table in the basement. So at least one night a week, I'd go over and we'd shoot pool. And one night I asked him, "Do you miss being not being on the farm?" And he said, "I only miss one thing." I said, "What's that?" He said, "Well, I always had a salt shaker on the windowsill in the barn, and I'd go out in the garden, and I'd get me a tomato and salt it down, and I just loved it." He said, "That's the only thing I miss." I said, "Well, George, my yard's too small to have a garden, but if we can dig up a corner of your yard, I'll furnish the labor and the plants and the seeds if we can use your yard." And he said, "You dig up as much as you want." So I dug it up. Well, you know how it is when you turn over sod the first few years. It's a battle. And I was out there on a Saturday starting to plant. And he came along and he said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm trying to plant some carrots." He said, "You aren't going to grow anything in there." This corner of the lot was where they dumped all the stuff during construction. And he went on in the house, and my wife came out shortly after that. She said, "I'm going up to the grocery store." I said, "If they have a bunch of carrots up there with the greens on, bring me a bunch," which she did. And I planted them. And on Tuesday, I didn't see George till Tuesday. He said, "You son of a gun, everybody I've told about those carrots wants some of that seed." That's the way we went back and forth. The next year, I put my tomato plants in, and I came out the next morning, and there's big plastic tomato hanging from one of those little plants. But that's the kind of relationship it was. And, you know, I think from my experience, if you are a good neighbor, your neighbor's going to be a good neighbor.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. Well, we know that the Hoosier State, one of the trains that would run from Northwest Indiana to Indianapolis and back on a regular basis, is no longer in service. Now there's concern that many of the Amtrak long-distance services may get cut as well, and that comes after the installation of a new guy in charge of Amtrak. All taking a look at the concerns, not only the impact that the Hoosier State's loss, at least for now anyway, is having on transport here in Northwest Indiana, but also, too, the impact overall that the changes that might come in Amtrak will, is Steve Coxhead. He's the president of the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance. And, Steve, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Thank you, Chris. Yeah.
And we mentioned here that we have a change in leadership with Amtrak. Somebody's taken over, and has put in place some ideas that are going to mean some cuts in service. Bring us up to date on we know, of course, we have no service now, mainly except for one train, the Cardinal, that runs through Northwest Indiana, and it's only so often during the week, not as often as the Hoosier State was running. What kind of overall service are we going to see eventually if it happens?
Well, yeah. Of course, we're lacking the Hoosier State, and the Cardinal is already 3 days 3 days a week. Northern Indiana actually has two trains that come through at inconvenient times to New York City and to Washington, D.C., across the Northern Corridor, mm-hmm. and those are daily trains. Under the proposed cuts, those would be cut back to three trains a week. It appears that, you know, Amtrak has people in charge of it who basically are, their experience is airlines, And the dynamics of an airline is not the same thing as the dynamics of a railroad. And what Amtrak is proposing to do is basically to eliminate daily service on all long-distance runs. And that would be any runs over, I think, something like 700, 800 miles. Those of us, and this is even though Amtrak is at the same time asked for a huge supplementary appropriation over $1 billion, billion with a B, to make up for fare losses due to the COVID-19 epidemic and the loss of ridership. Most of us who follow rail issues understand that if you cut a train back from daily to 3 days a week, you lose ridership. And historically, what has happened is that railroads have done this when they are trying to make a case for discontinuing service. Basically, they cut the service back to the point where it's no longer viable, so people stop using it. And then they come to the federal government and say, ah, look, no one is using the service. No one is really sure what is going on here. It would appear Amtrak intends to abandon the idea of a national network and maintain the Northeast Corridor, that is service from Boston down through Washington, D.C., and maybe some disconnected regional routes. What they're saying is they have to do this to save money. And as I said, this actually is a completely false argument because you take a train that's set up to run 7 days a week and you cut it down to three, you're actually going to lose money because there are fixed costs, okay? Let's say if you set up a business, you know, you've got rent, you've got mortgage, you've got inventory cost, insurance, all sorts of things that you have to pay out as a businessman, whether or not any customers walk in through the door or not. So if only three customers walk in the door, that means your cost per customer is very high. If seven customers walk in the door, that means your cost per customer is lower. So basically, on all the long-distance routes, if Amtrak cuts back from 7 days to 3 days, they're going to still have all the fixed costs of those long-distance routes, but now they'll have fewer passengers to spread the cost over. So we do think this is a deliberate attempt to abandon the idea of a national network. Now, what we need to remind people, our viewers, our listeners, and everyone else, is that Amtrak is required by law to provide a national network. Under current law, Amtrak is not required to make a profit, okay? It is not a private business. It is not required by law to make a profit. It is required by law to provide a national service to the people of the United States. The ownership of Amtrak is held by the federal government. So the recent developments seem to be a movement completely away from this idea. Now, I know several senators, both Republican and Democrat, have signed on to one of two or three different letters that have been sent to Amtrak. Chairman objecting to this approach. One of these letters, signed on by Senator Braun of Indiana, was reprinted in our most recent edition of our newsletter, All Aboard Indiana. We commend Senator Braun for that. And like I said, there's been several other senators and I think some representatives also who have signed letters. There's been two or three letters of this nature circulating, basically questioning Amtrak's logic, reasoning, and basic truthfulness. So this is a problem. It looks like Amtrak, for whatever reasons, is in charge, is being run currently by people who want to back away from Amtrak's legal and legitimate purpose. Why would this be happening? You know, go figure. These are certainly strange times.
Well, you figure too that if their intent was to be able to boost the airlines, number one, the airlines aren't going to be covering the same type of service that the trains do. We'll just take the Hoosier State Line, for example, the stops of several cities along the line in Indiana. They're not going to have a plane service, a puddle jumper. make those routes. They used to, some of the airlines used to make, of course, they were doing cities further apart than what we were talking about here, that, you know, maybe only, you know, 50, 100 miles apart from each other. But the idea is that they don't have the same type of service. So airplanes are not going to be able to do that. And if you completely eliminate the train service, it's going to make things much difficult for everybody, it would seem.
Exactly. And if you look at what's happening in the airline industry, they are clearly moving to a situation where they really only want long-distance routes, okay, in the airline industry. A lot of the shorter hops and so forth are being eliminated, and they're clearly moving to an area where they think that their future lies in serving long-distance routes. You know, whereas in Amtrak, the long-distance routes appear to be not in favor. And yes, if you have, for instance, just the little example of the Hoosier State, Indianapolis to Chicago, all of those trips are not Indianapolis to Chicago. You have Indianapolis to Crawfordsville. You have Crawfordsville to Rensselaer. You have Crawfordsville to Chicago. And that's the thing about a long-distance train. If you're covering, for instance, New York to Chicago, D.C. to Chicago, you are serving numerous intermediate points. For instance, the Cardinal, which originates in New York City, comes into D.C. and Cincinnati, Indianapolis, up to Chicago. It stops in Plainfield, which is east of Indianapolis. It also stops in Crawfordsville. You could take the Cardinal, for instance, from Cincinnati to Crawfordsville if you needed to. And you can make a similar example on any long-distance train. And I think studies have been done that have shown that if you take any given long-distance train, a minority of passengers are going from the beginning point to the end point. The majority of passengers are getting on and departing at intermediate points. Mm-hmm. Now, that's something a train does well. It's something, in fact, you can't do with an airline. You know, as you say, we don't have puddle jumpers. No. You know, we have large aircraft that fly long distances. So the train serves, you know, not two endpoints, but it serves several intermediate points in a corridor. And I think that's what we're trying to do, and that's why we're pushing for the state to restart the Hoosier State, is because that serves several communities within that corridor from Indianapolis up through Chicago. It doesn't just serve the two endpoints.
Mm-hmm. What is the latest, by the way, Steve, on what the efforts might be taken here in the upcoming General Assembly, or at least discussions prior to the General Assembly in January, to try to get life back in, at least as far as state support of the Hoosier State line is concerned?
Well, now, and of course, you have to preface everything by understanding that due to the lower economic activity, due to the current epidemic, I think state of Indiana's budget short revenue shortfall for the current year is like 15%, okay? Our understanding is that Governor Holcomb has basically passed the words that all departments of the state government are supposed to retrench because the money isn't there.
Right.
That being said, we are working with NDOT and, you know, some other parties to press forward on the idea of applying for a series of federal grants. There are federal grants available for restoring or improving passenger service. We are going ahead with a plan to apply for grants, you know, over time to improve the physical plan between Indianapolis and, in fact, Dyer.
Right.
You know, originally the plan was for NDOT to apply directly. Now, because of problems with the state finding money, we may have to actually have the technically the party that applies for these grants be one of the cities, let's say, on the route. But we are moving ahead with that. The state, of course, is moving ahead with getting ready to begin construction on the South Shore Railroad's extension from Hammond down to Dyer, so that would be ready to pick up trains from Indianapolis. So things are moving forward. Unfortunately, they're pretty much in the background, and they're moving more slowly than we would like. You know, this the current epidemic, you know, has thrown a spanner in the works for everyone's plans.
That's for sure.
But the state of Indiana is moving forward, You know, as far as we know now, the intent of all the parties involved is to have state service running by around 2024. Now, you know, there's, what do they say about, you know, many things can trip up the best laid plans, you know, but that is the plan. NDOT and the state of Indiana, to the best of their ability under current circumstances, is moving forward. There have been some talks with communities along the line to actually be the formal requester, you know, of the federal grant. And, of course, as we all know, it's hard to actually predict what's going to come out of Washington these days. And, of course, that would why that is would be a whole different discussion, as you're no doubt aware. But I think we have to agree that it is difficult to plan on money monies coming out of D.C. for any purpose right now. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. But we are moving forward. We're moving forward on that. We're also moving forward on possibly getting what we've styled the Indiana Passenger Rail Commission, which would be a framework for coordinating NDOT, the South Shore Railroad, and the various advocacy groups in the state, so they could all move in the same direction, you know, in combined forces. So things are happening. Unfortunately, they're not things that are making the headlines, and they're very much background. But these things definitely are happening.
Well, Steve, thank you very much for spending time going over with the latest here. That is, once again, it's in the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance newsletter, and find out more about that. But about the situation involving Amtrak and the possibility we might see some life come back to the Hoosier State. And we'll have you back on again. And we've also been asked, too, about, I guess, just in general terms, is why it seems to work overseas but not here in the States. And that would be a whole conversation in itself right there, it sounds like, too. And maybe we can take that up the next time we talk.
You know, it would be, Chris, and it would be fascinating, because you're absolutely right. Things are much different in other countries that, in many respects, are very much like the United States.
Steve Coxett is the president of the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and here online at lakeshorepublicradio.org. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us today on the program. Tomorrow, we will have a conversation with the CEO of the Chicago-based Big Shoulders Fund, Josh Hale. They're doing their best, with a special help from some folks in Northwest Indiana, make some efforts to help the Diocese of Gary school system, and we hope you can join us for that.